Made possible with support from Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Learn about Krannert Center's 2004-2005 performance season with guest artists Emmylou Harris, Nathan Gunn, and Ralph Lemon by visiting krannertcenter.com or stopping by to pick up a season brochure.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Travis Stancil, and Henry Frain is at the controls. I'm going to tell you just real quick what we'll be doing on the program on Monday. We are going to be running a couple of archive programs, so we'll not be taking calls. We hope that you'll enjoy, nonetheless, listening to these shows. One of them is from March and one is from April. In the first hour, you'll be hearing an interview that I had in March with Ajuige Dantica. She is a Haitian-American writer. Been very well regarded for her work. Her most recent book is entitled The Dewbreaker, and I talked with her, well, the point where she was traveling around the country talking about the book. That'll be in the first part of the show. Hour number two, we will look at how show business has taken over the White House, and our guest for that program, Alan Schroeder. This was from an archive from April. He's professor of journalism at Northeastern University and has written a book on this. It's titled Celebrity in Chief. So that'll be our number two on Monday. Then we'll be back at our usual spot and time and taking calls on the 1st of June on Tuesday, talking with Joseph Rahm. He's executive director of the Center for Energy and Climate Solutions, talking about hydrogen. And he takes kind of a contrarian view about the possibilities of hydrogen for the economy in the future. And he's written a book on this titled The Hype About Hydrogen. Then in hour two, we'll be talking about last year's East Coast blackout and the power grid in North America and what has been done or maybe hasn't been done to try to make sure something like that doesn't happen again. And there we'll be talking with a couple of guests here from the University of Illinois, George Gross, and also Peter Sawyer, both of them professors of electrical and computer engineering. So that's next week. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. We're also pleased to have here in the studio with us this morning, Congressman Tim Johnson. He represents the 15th District here in Illinois. We have a lot of listeners in the 15th. It is a big district, includes Champaign-Urbana, Bloomington-Normal, Decatur, and we like from time to time to try to give you an opportunity to have a little direct contact with your member of Congress. So that's what this program is about. I can ask questions, but more important, it's your opportunity to do that. So if you'd like to call in and talk with him here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
David, I'm grateful for you allowing me the opportunity to be here. I always enjoy this show, enjoy the questions, and enjoy your stewardship over it.
Well, at the risk of opening up a subject that will never get off, I feel I have to ask you about Iraq. We now seem to be at a point where more and more people are worried about where we're headed, unhappy with the decisions that have been taken. The president's popularity continues to decline. And I'm not sure anybody has a real good solution. Let me ask you, what do you think about everything that's happened up to this point? And do you still think that it was the right thing to do?
I would guess of the 435 members of Congress and the 700,000 people that I represent, there are probably that many different opinions, variable opinions, in terms of the wisdom of the initial incursion, as well as our continued presence and various steps along the way. I'm not really here to be, David, an apologist for the administration. I'm here to say that there have clearly been mistakes made, and unfortunately there have probably been mistakes more made, not only American, but other lives lost. As to whether to go back and put myself in the situation of a year and a half ago and make a determination as to whether we did the right thing or not, you know, that's a Monday morning quarterbacking, and I'm loath to do that. But I will say that I, along with my constituents, have a lot of concerns. And at the same time, I think there's a lot under the radar screen that's happening that's very positive. Members of both parties, both chambers, have visited Iraq and come back with the report nearly unanimous, nearly, I say, that the people are free, that people are happy to have American presence there, and that there's tremendous progress economically, socially, and otherwise being made that sometimes flies under the radar screen. All that said, there are a number of gigantic problems, and I believe, along with many of my constituents, that we are in a lose-lose situation, and we need to make sure that within the confines of an appropriate mission, that we don't embroil ourselves in another Vietnam.
The administration seems determined to stand by the deadline it set of June 30th for handover control to a provisional government. Do you think that it makes sense to continue to stand by that because we don't have much more time now? I mean, would it make sense to say, all right, we said June 30th, but why June 30th? Why not July 30th or August 30th?
Well, first of all, the provisional government is one that then will be in place for about a six-month period of time until the first free elections that have been held in the Middle East, perhaps ever. And that's certainly liberating history a little bit, but as of the first of the year. And so I do believe that with the appropriate oversight and with the provisional authority as we expect it to be as of June 1st or as of June 30th, that it's probably the best option at this point. I think it shows progress. I think it shows that we're inclined to be leaving rather than staying, that while there's many pitfalls ahead, that it's a realistic turnover time, and hopefully during that provisional authority time and their control over the government, that free elections will take place, and that ultimately not only America but the Middle East and the world will be a safer place to live and a freer place to live.
How long do you think American troops will have to stay in Iraq?
You know, David, if I had the answer to that, I would probably be running for something other than what I'm running for. I don't have a prediction. I will say simply as a matter of policy that I hope it's sooner rather than later that our exit occurs.
We have a couple of callers here. First over in Belgium, near Danville, line number 4.
Going to be over around that area today.
Hello. He was just saying he was going to be over there.
I'm going to be over in Danville. I'm leaving after the show for Danville, but I'm not going to get south on Route 1, but I'll be there soon.
I was going to say, where are you going to stay in Belgium? But that's another question.
yeah, if you can find a place for me in Belgium to stay, it's a wonderful community, but there's probably not a lot of Holiday Inns there.
Not very big. I don't want to bring up the topic of the an enormous amount of money we spent there, the number of lives that have been lost in this escapade. But I would like to point out to you, and I hope that you can have some kind of legislative effect on the topic that I'm going to bring up. We've lost, 1,000, 2,000 people in this horrid war, but nobody has mentioned, nobody has even touched the subject, broached it all, of how many thousands of men and women who have been seriously maimed in this war and have been brought back to the United States to face a very, very, very tenuous, a very tenuous future, in that the VA budget has been reduced and reduced and reduced, and the Danville area having a VA hospital, it's being made smaller and smaller. These people have given their all to our country for a very poor policy, and now we're not going to be able to support them when they've been seriously maimed, lose limbs, anything like this. Surely, sir, there's something we can do in Congress.
You have put your finger on a gigantic issue. The VA hospital is not only a provider of services who've given their all to this nation, but it's also obviously a economic fulcrum in the Danville area. I have made the Veterans Administration a gigantic priority to me. I brought over the deputy director on at least one, if not two, occasions. We've made some significant progress there. John Morris, out of our Danville office, probably spends 80% of his constituent time dealing with VA issues. One of the reasons, and I think your question is implicitly asking me for this, why I voted against the VA HUD budget last year,
exactly,
was because it was because, and I was one of a very few Republicans to vote against it, because I didn't think it was sufficient. You can clearly point to horror stories. On the other hand, the people that are there are doing an extraordinarily good job, and we've simply got to do better in being able to terms of providing the however you feel about Iraq, however you might have felt about the Korean War or World War II or Vietnam. The bottom line is we made a commitment to people who have served this country, and we need to keep it. My hope and expectation is that we're going to do better, and I believe that the glass is half full rather than half empty. And in terms of dealing with John Morris and in terms of dealing with the administration there, I think we've made some major progress. As a matter of fact, I think there's some suggestion that the VA may be expanding services rather than contracting them. But at least we want to keep them there, upgrade the services, and keep the commitment we made to people who've given their all to this country.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thank you for the call. Next, we'll go to Urbana, line one.
Hello.
Is your caller there, Urbana, line one? Well, what do you say we try Urbana line two?
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I have some questions about the Medicare drug program that's going to go into effect in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Actually, not to correct you, but the program has gone into place in part now through the issuance of discount cards. But you're right. The full program goes into effect at the beginning of 2006.
And is this mandatory if you are Medicare Social Security?
It is not. It is optional.
Okay.
It's an optional program.
If you have a better plan from your employer, you're not required to participate in that unless your employer or your retirement benefit calls upon you to do so?
Absolutely right. The program is entirely optional, and it's one that a good many people will choose not to participate in. And so that's a question that's been asked. We actually had a series of four town meetings about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, I remember, but I couldn't.
Oh, no, I understand. Let me give you and the listeners a couple of numbers to call in our office, because I realize, like, just like the Farm Bill or just like any new project, information is half the battle. And so you got to know what's available and what isn't. In our Bloomington office, Beth Harding is an expert on all these matters.
Okay.
And Beth can be reached at 309 663-7049. Again, 309-663-7049. In Washington, and I hate to have someone have to make a long distance call.
Well, that would be long distance to Bloomington.
Yeah, well, I'm going to give you two local numbers too.
Okay, that's fine. Give me the local numbers, that'll be fine.
Yeah. In Champaign, it's four. You want Champaign or Danville?
Champaign.
Yeah, Champaign, it's obviously area code 217. 403-4690.
403. I'm sorry, I didn't.
4690.
4690. Okay. Now, I also understood that, and perhaps I'm wrong about this, is that there was going to be some kind of graduated income tax on Medicare from that point on. Is that true?
A graduated income tax on Medicare?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, this was something that a number of years ago was proposed, that if you made over a certain amount of money, you would not your Medicare premiums would go up based upon your income. Is that a part of that bill?
There is an element of the bill that is geared into need, but it also the program is accessible basically to everybody. But there is a need factor built into it as well. It's kind of a delicate combination between the two, and quite frankly, in a 800 or 1,000 page bill, if I were to sit here and tell you that I knew every jot and tittle on the legislation, I would be less than honest with you. I can tell you, though, that we could certainly provide those answers for you and would be glad to do.
I just wanted to make a statement about that, if that is true, and that is that, for those of us who saved, that is kind of a big slap in the face.
No,
having
I understand.
And because now we are required to take out of our 403B plans and all of that, so your income in essence has gone up, but yet you can't save any. Like, it takes one of our retirements to pay our income tax as it is now. And so you think that is built into it?
There is, but I will tell you that and again, not to be patronizing, but you're right, and the question you raised was a valid one, and frankly, the alternative, I don't want to be partisan here, but it was called the Democratic alternative, is one that would have gone precisely the opposite direction as what you want to hit. So what the ultimate product that emerged is one that I think that by and large you would like. It provides an incentive and no disincentive for people who've been wise in terms of planning for their retirement, planning for a prescription drug program, but at the same time reaches out to the most needy of people. So I think it's a reasonable compromise, not perfect, but a reasonable compromise.
So you think there is some certain levels that you would have to pay more?
There is, not that you'd pay more, but that you'd get more at a lower level. You don't have to pay more. You just have to, you'd receive more benefits.
That doesn't bother me.
That's what I'm talking about in terms of need. The need base is that people who are the most needy have the most access to the program. That's the quickest way I can say it.
What do you mean by the most access?
Well, there's more benefits available with less or no deductibles if you have a lower income than if you have a higher income.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'm not explaining myself too well. The bottom line is this. There's not a penalty on people who've planned well and have been successful in planning for their retirement and their needs.
Okay.
There is a greater access with less financial penalty to the benefits of the program for people who are in most need based on their lower income.
That's fine. Yeah, but there is no penalty for those of us who have been prudent.
No, there's not. There's not, and there shouldn't be, and there won't be.
Yeah, so if I call your office, I can get some literature or something.
You certainly can get everything you want to get, and we'll be more than happy to supply it to you.
Well, some of your people in your office have been very helpful to us in the past.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. I'm very grateful.
I wrote you a letter about it a couple of years ago.
Well, thanks so much. You're very kind to say that.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks
for
the call. There's one question I want to ask you about this Medicare legislation, and that's this. Back in March, the chief actuary, Richard Foster, testifying before Congress, said that he had provided to the White House the previous year in 2003 data showing that the prescription drug legislation would cost between 25% and 50% more than the administration was saying. He said that he had shared this information with the President's Special Assistant for Health Policy and the Associate Director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, and he said that Thomas Scully, who was the administrator of Medicare, told him not to tell the Congress the real figures. Do any members in Congress feel a little bit snookered on this deal? Or, you know, maybe it would have passed anyway, but what this guy is saying is that the White House says, don't tell Congress how much this is really going to cost.
If that, in fact, is the case, this is one member of Congress who would be very, very chagrined. I'm a Republican, and not embarrassed to be a Republican, but I've got as much right to be informed about issues, and a Democrat member of Congress does as well. And any withholding of information that's relevant to our decision-making process from any level of authority, Republican, Democrat, or in between, is unacceptable to me.
So, as far as this is news to you,
no, I know the story that you're talking about, and I'm not suggesting it's not true. I'm telling you that if it is true, I'm not happy. I'm not sure it would have changed my vote, but I'm not happy because I like to have full information when I vote. I haven't guaranteed the authenticity of those reports that indicated that the information was withheld. But any information that a program that was purported to be $390 billion is really a $550 billion program, and that information isn't conveyed to members of Congress when we vote on it. I'm not an economist. I do the best I can, but I'm by very nature, a collector of information, and I have to rely on certain data that's supplied to me. And if data isn't inaccurate, if it's inaccurate, I want to know about it.
So, but as far as you know, no, at this point, nobody in Congress is saying, well, we really ought to get to the bottom of this and find out why we were told what we were told and what the real straight deal
was. Yeah, in fact, most of the complaints in that regard are coming from conservative Republicans who felt that their vote was cast based on one figure, and that some of them would have cast a different vote had they known it would have been half again as expensive.
Yeah. All right. Do you think, though, it would have passed?
I believe it probably would have, because I believe a promise was made to enact a prescription drug program, and while certainly those figures are large figures, I think that the bill probably would have passed anyway.
All right. Well, let's go on some other callers here. Go to next caller in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much for coming to this program. I would like to go back to the issue of Iraq And I listened to you also after the war and after the invasion and the occupation of Iraq. And you said you have very reliable sources that Iraq has the weapon of mass destruction, Iraq has the connection with Al-Qaeda, Iraq has this and that. And
no, but before we go off on a question that's based on a premise that's not entirely accurate,
well,
I didn't indicate that I had reliable information. I indicated there were certainly suggestions made that there were weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I listened to you so many times, and you emphasized that you have the sources which we don't have. You have access. People, they showed you that. And actually, even Secretary of State Colin Powell, in front of the whole world when he went to the United Nations, then later he admitted they didn't give him the right information. So the mistake being it happened. The disaster took place. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, either they killed or they injured, as well as innocent lives of American boys and girls. Hundreds of billions of dollars being damaged in Iraq, and also we are putting all these tens of billions of dollars. The scandal in Abu Ghraib prison and many other prisons came to the surface, which we knew about it before it came to the media. And I didn't see one person to stood up and say, we are ashamed of ourselves and resign from his post. I have no idea why. You mentioned also, just let me give you more information. You said that Iraq is better off now economically. They are free. They are doing fine. I'm afraid that the same reliable sources they gave it to you before, they are giving you this information. Iraq has 60% of their own people without job. Believe it or not, people, they cannot send their children to school because they are afraid their children will be killed or kidnapped. Professional people, so far, 250 Iraqis, professional people, doctors, physicians, professors, they've been killed in the street of Baghdad.
So what you're suggesting is that you're suggesting the years under Hussein were people were happier than now, right?
I was against Saddam before you, by the way. I am anti-Saddam since day number one when he took power.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is the situation is not as good as you described to me. Or when I listen to some official people, it's really bad. People, they don't have food to eat now. It's not safe. And if you listen yesterday to the news, one member of the Iraqi Governing Council, while she's traveling, was attacked with her people. 1 week ago, another person in the Iraqi Governing Council was killed. And a few months ago, another Iraqi Governing Council was killed. Where is the security? Where is the safety? Where is Iraq is better off than before? The Iraqi people are really glad Saddam Hussein is gone. But now, unless we do something, this country do something to change the heart and the mind of the Iraqis, they will say, well, before is better than now. So please don't tell me it is better off than before, because the people, they need food on their tables. They need health services. They need schools. They need many other things. I was there, and I saw the horrible situation. I couldn't leave my family's house because it's not safe. I went to see my sick mother, and I couldn't leave the house because it's horrible. I couldn't visit my brother in another town or my in-laws in another town. It is horrible. Please don't keep misleading the American people. Let the American people know the real, the facts, so at least we can work it together and get out of there as soon as possible.
Well, you're certainly helping do that right now by adding your voice to people who've been there. So I'm listening to you.
Yeah. So please, if you want to know more facts, I can give my phone number to the studio, and I can sit with you and I tell you a lot of facts which you don't know about it. So you are in a position. You are here to help us. And I appreciate, as the lady before, you are always very good, helpful, very helpful to this community. And you have to be very good help also to the whole United States of America. We lost our moral responsibility in the whole world. The people outside are not trusting us anymore. So please let us do something to repair the damage which took place. Thank you very much.
No, I appreciate your comments.
Well, thank you for the call. Do you think that the Congress was given enough good information so they could make an informed decision as to whether or not it was the right thing to do to go into Iraq militarily?
I don't think there was any effort on the part of the administration to deliberately mislead the Congress. But that's a different question than determining whether the adequate information or full sufficient information was given to us that we could make as educated decisions as we'd like. I'm not suggesting that my vote would have been different. Again, I don't want to be a Monday morning quarterback. Mm-hmm. But I am suggesting that clearly, as the caller pointed out, and a number of others has as well, anybody who doesn't learn from past mistakes or failure to inform themselves completely is doomed to repeat history. And so if I could go and be a Monday morning quarterback, I'd like to have more complete information with respect to what's there and what isn't and what our options are and what they aren't. But you can't live in the past. You have to live in the present, and we do the best we can.
Well, as a result of that, I know a lot of people in Washington are talking about intelligence gathering and how it is that we try to decide what's going on and what decisions we make. We've got a commission now that's now has for months and months been spending hours and hours looking back at 9/11 and asking questions about that and could it have been prevented and did we do all the right thing, and they're going to have a report out this summer. As you look at all of this discussion, what do you think about how the intelligence gathering agencies in the United States are structured, how they work with one another? What sort of lessons do you think we have learned so far from all of this?
One of the lessons we've learned is that the coordination of intelligence functions before 9/11 and certainly before Iraq and even now has a tremendous amount of broken holes that need to be repaired. And from every dark cloud comes some silver lining. And the silver lining ultimately, hopefully, would be a dramatic upgrade, a modernization, and improvement of our intelligence gathering and coordination system to bring it into the 21st century.
We are at about our midpoint here. We have a number of other callers. We'll try to get in as many people as we can. Folks can help us by also trying to be brief. Our guest is Tim Johnson. He is a member of Congress representing the 15th District here in Illinois. A lot of our listeners in the 15th, and we have him here just so that you can talk to him. We'll go to McLean County for our next, and that's line four.
We were in McLean County 2 days ago.
Hi.
Enjoyed your hospitality. Had lunch out at the mall.
So glad. A couple of the callers before me have commented on things that I had on my list, so I won't rehash those. So I think the previous caller was quite on the money. But one theme that seems to run through your discussion and what comes out of the administration is the theme of plausible deniability. And, you know, you can throw this stuff off and call it Monday morning quarterbacking all you like, but these are very serious things that have happened, and even though you didn't catch on to the fact that there were some inconsistencies in the administration, I know many people in your district weren't fooled by them. So my remaining question would be, why do you think you ought to be retained in your current position this November? And I'll hang up and free up the line for someone else. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. I don't want to use this show as a one-sided opportunity to engage in a debate about re-election. So since the question was asked, I guess I can address the question, but I don't want to be accused of campaigning with no opponent here. We probably had, I don't know, thousands of votes in the United States Congress, ranging from the environment, the budget, national defense, prescription drugs, social services, Head Start. That's one of the reasons I was in Bloomington the other day. A wide variety of issues on a public policy level, and 300 times that many issues on a level of people who don't get their Social Security check on time, who have a VA disability claim mishandled, who didn't get a Farm Bill check on time, where a road needs to be fixed in Cumberland County, or two interchanges or a multimodal system in McLean County upgraded or established. Our job is an endless job that has the best staff in Washington, D.C., and overall, I believe that my service in terms of those individual concerns, community needs, as well as policy matters, while I'm sure that everybody, including members of my own family, would disagree with at least some of my votes. Matt Bisbee sitting here next to me, and he's my confidant, one of my best friends, And as we go along the road, we discuss issues we disagree on all the time. But the bottom line is, I believe that my service has been responsible, it's been responsive, and I've given the best effort that God has given me the ability to do, and I hope that's sufficient to reelect me. And quite frankly, if it isn't, then they'll choose the alternative, and I'll be on a permanent retirement basis.
Okay. Well, I hope they get to the question of the caller. We did think about this program this morning as a kind of a talk to the congressman show. But also, of course, as we get closer to the election this fall, we'll be putting out the invitations again, as we always do, to candidates who are running for office in our area. And as many as are willing to be on the show will be on the show. And, of course, at that point, we'll give you the opportunity to talk with Mr. Johnson's opponent in the fall. And I'm sure he'll be back on the show and a lot of other candidates
Certainly welcome that. I've frankly never had the opportunity to meet the gentleman, but I'm looking forward to that opportunity.
All right. Next, back here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, when I see the annual budget bills being tied together in one or more omnibus bills, I think that's indicative of bad congressional management. Has your committees put out by your Ag Committee been put in omnibus bills? And if so, what can you do to prevent these from happening next time around?
One of the things we can do is to give the president line item veto authority. That's equivalent to the reduction authority or the authority that the governor has in Illinois that I believe ultimately results in more fiscal responsibility, and that's something
that constitutional amendment.
It may, but I don't think so. I haven't sufficiently researched to know whether you could do that by legislation or constitutional amendment. One way or the other, whether it takes a constitutional amendment or legislation, I believe that line item veto authority is important. We don't vote we vote a budget resolution, and we did last week. But there are 13 separate appropriations matters. 13 separate appropriations bills that come through the process. Now, would I like to see me have the opportunity and other members of Congress the opportunity to vote on individual items and that I may not be entirely enthralled with as one of those 13 bills? Of course I would. But I also think that you reach a point at any level of government, whether it's the federal, state, or local government, when voting on every single item on a $2.4 trillion budget would be unworkable.
That's not quite what I meant. But, there are, like you said, 13 annual budget bills. Well, that's 13 votes, but during a previous federal fiscal year, weren't some of those 13 bills tied together in omnibus bills and allowed to slide through with a lot of pork barrel projects thrown in?
There are the 13 separate appropriations matters each stand on their own. There is a budget resolution, which isn't binding. That's the entire budget that lays out a blueprint. But the appropriations matters, and we're being technical here, but you obviously have the expertise, so you know what I'm talking about. The appropriations matters are all standalone matters with respect to those 13 particular areas. Are there pork barrel projects contained within a $2.4 trillion federal budget? If I told you no, you'd turn off the show and think that's the biggest liar whoever was on radio.
Got that right.
So I would also suggest that that what some people call pork barrel, I don't. There are certainly some projects that are gross mismanagement and mis-expenditure of public money.
Does one congressman call another congressman out on something that's truly egregious? Have you ever done it?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Of course, that happens quite frequently. But I will tell you that the Curtis Road improvement here in Champaign County, I don't consider that a pork barrel project. I consider that something that's important to the economic development of Champaign County. I consider the park and ride facility so that on South Campus, as that develops, people will be able to have access and facilities for daycare for their kids. I don't consider that pork barrel. I consider that part of government social services. I consider when the federal government funds or the state government funds Lincoln's Challenge and Rantoul, or what used to be called Hope for the Children, Brenda Ehart's Generations of Hope, I don't think that's pork barrel. I think those are social services that are needed and something that I'm very proud to support. On the other hand, if we're going to build a memorial to the some obscure matter out in Pennsylvania that nobody cares about that's going to be a tourist boon for some particular area that doesn't have any basis historically or otherwise, and that's Pork Barrel. And I don't know where you draw the line. It's like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. If it's in my district, I try to make it useful, and I try to make it something that I think is in the best interest of the people of the district.
Thank you.
All right. Let me ask you a general question, because I know that some people, when they look at, generally speaking, the budget in the big sense and where the money is going, that they're distressed that, now it's perhaps inescapable, but they're distressed that the war in Iraq, the war on terror, defense generally is soaking up so much money, and the domestic spending is languishing, and they point to things like No Child Left Behind, for example, that the Bush administration counts as one of their great achievements, but it's never been fully funded. Are you, when you look at where the money goes, are you unhappy about how things are allocated, and particularly on the domestic side of things?
There are certainly areas that don't make me happy, and some areas that are underfunded and other areas that are overfunded. If you're asking me, David, if I am in agreement with every single item that's contained in any one of those appropriations matters, the answer is no. Overall, I voted against the VA HUD appropriation because I didn't think it represented appropriate public policy and didn't meet the needs of the VA. I voted in favor of the appropriations that contained the appropriations for the Department of Agriculture because I felt on balance it was something that served felt needs. And so in terms of a budget, and I'm not trying to be an apologist for the system because I realize the system can be reformed and it should be reformed. But the bottom line is, ultimately, you have to vote green or red on an appropriations matter that will contain perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars for appropriations for grants for research for the University of Illinois, combined with another appropriations to another university that I think probably is misspent. And I don't like to be put in those situations any more than anybody else, but the bottom line is, I have to take my voting card and vote yes or no. And you make a collective judgment, or at least an aggregated judgment, on what you think's right and wrong. And my record speaks for itself.
Well, let's keep talking here with people who are listening. Line two is next in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Going back to the torture abuse situation in Iraq, one of the Defense Department's apparent moves to correct this situation would be to prohibit service members carrying cameras. This doesn't seem to me to make very good sense. It seems to me that the pictures were actually fortuitous in that they led to the correction of the situation. We'd heard rumors of this for some time, but it was not until the pictures surfaced that anything started to be done.
The bottom line is the situation as it transpired at that prison that's been revealed by the pictures is absolutely and totally unacceptable. It lowers our standards. It is inhumane. It is not what we're there for. It is not what we purport to stand for. And as one member of Congress, I'm embarrassed by it.
Well, my question is, what will Congress do about a prohibition of cameras?
I wasn't aware that there was any proposal.
It has been. The Defense Department has proposed that.
I was not aware of that. You just brought that to my attention, and I will certainly look at that.
I appreciate that. It seems to me most
well, that's certainly I think that's certainly begging the point as far as the abuse. The fact that it's documented doesn't mean it didn't occur.
No.
So I would suggest that that's a bit disingenuous, not on your part, but on the part of people who would make that suggestion.
Well, that's my feeling, and I would appreciate your looking into it.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We'll go on to next caller. This is also Urbana, line three. Hello.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've got a problem with the way things are going in general in government, and particularly coming from the Republican side, where whenever dissent occurs, regardless of whether it's the Democrats or whether it's their own Republicans, that when dissent pops up, the tactic is to discredit and bash the criticizer without looking at him, looking at what the man has to say. When critics came about early on, prior to our invasion of Iraq, when the generals and ambassadors criticized what the government wanted to do, they were discredited and bashed. Whenever there's any dissent that has shown up in the past 4 years, it is embarrassing to me. It should be embarrassing to you as a congressional person to allow this to happen. The tone coming from the right has been absolutely horrendous. I can only liken it to the propagandists that were coming that played around in Germany prior to World War II. It is a shame the way that they have dragged our country from something that I was proud in, and I served in the military, to something that I am now ashamed of. And I call upon you, if you get reelected, because I'm certainly not going to vote for anybody Republican this time around, you had better take the assignment to go forward and make this government more interactive and to make it more open to the American people. And that's all I have to say. You can say what you want about it.
Well, I guess what I would say is that first of all, I think to compare the atmosphere that currently exists to Nazism before 1939 is a bit of an extreme proposition, but the caller certainly has. That's what a great thing about America. The First Amendment allows you to say whatever you want to say. I think that my reputation as a member of Congress from this area and in general in Washington has been one that's been very balanced by anybody's observation. The only people that call the shots for me are my own conscience and people like the caller and others who input to me. There are issues ranging from fiscal issues, taxes, and otherwise, where I've supported the administration. There are other issues ranging from the environment to campaign finance reform to labor management issues where I have opposed the administration. And as a result, I think I've acquired the reputation of not being embarrassed to be a Republican, being somebody who is a very reasonable person who tries to respond to the issues and tries to respond to the constituency in a fairly and hopefully very balanced way. And I don't have anybody telling me how to think. I'm an independent thinker. I take a lot of pride in that. And I listened to the caller who just called in, who I frankly think is a little bit extreme in his comparison to 1939. But nonetheless, I listened to that individual just as much as I listened to somebody who was very strongly in support of some of the positions of the administration. People have learned over time now in my 4 years there that they certainly can lobby me. They can certainly give me input within the Beltway. But ultimately, I'm going to make a decision based on what I think is right, based on what my constituent wants, and based on what I believe my conscience dictates.
On again. Line number one is the next caller in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, great talking to you. You know, one thing I like about you is that whether you agree or disagree with somebody, you're willing to talk to them. And I don't think that that's common in politics, Republican or Democrat. So I appreciate that. Two quick comments.
Well, I appreciate you. I'm not sure I'm talking to, but I appreciate your nice comments.
You know, I've written you multiple times. You always write back, and it's not just a form letter. And that's something I respect a tremendous amount.
Well, thank you.
So it's always good to interact.
God bless you. Thank you.
The last caller you were talking about who compared the Bush administration to kind of the conditions in Nazi Germany, not necessarily saying Bush was a Nazi, but given all of the freedoms of individual rights that have been taken away through the Patriot Act and others, I'm a little surprised that you're so blithe in writing them off. But that's really the minor issue. The major issue.
Let me point out, I am one of 12 Republican sponsors of what's called the FAIR Act. That's initiated by Representative Otter from Idaho. And the intention of the FAIR Act is to do substantial modifications, not total repeal, but substantial modifications of the Patriot Act to eliminate or pare back many of what now have turned out to be, in my judgment, excesses of the Patriot Act. So I would tell you that that I'm not overly enthralled and wasn't at the time overly enthralled with the Patriot Act. I do believe that there were certain upgrades that need to be made, but I think we overstepped in some areas.
Do you have that information on your website?
I don't know if it's on the website, but you can certainly get it from us, and we'll be glad to supply the information. It's called the FAIR Act, and we have bipartisan support, and I think we're going to hopefully get it passed.
Oh, I'd love to hear about that. So that's great. The other question I wanted to ask was, in terms of the line item veto, I'm a little curious how you're going to explain this. When Bill Clinton was president, Republicans en masse were rabidly against the line item veto. They thought that pretty much that America would end and possibly all humanity would end if Bill Clinton had line item veto power. Now all of a sudden Bush gets in, and boy, line item seems like a smart idea, sensical. It's common sense. It's not radical at all. How do you justify making a decision about how the national budget gets set based on the personality of an individual president, and we can even expand that to based on whether the president's a Republican or Democrat.
So well, I would explain that by saying that I wasn't in Congress when Bill Clinton was president.
Well, you remember the party.
Well, that would be like judging all Presbyterians based on what other Presbyterians stand for.
You said today that you were unabashedly Republican.
No, I did not say that. I said I was not embarrassed to be a Republican, and I'm not. I will tell you that I would be in favor of the line item veto whether Bill Clinton were president or Al Gore were president or George Bush were president.
Well, are you willing to make this a permanent part of...
I will vote for the line item veto no matter who's president as long as I'm in Congress.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. That's a very direct answer, and I think that's... a more honest perspective than a lot of your Republican compatriots have been willing to take. So, once again, I always appreciate talking to you, and you're at least willing to give a straight answer to a straight question, and that's the best of politics.
Well, you're willing to give a straight question, and I appreciate callers like you.
All right. Thanks. Well, thanks. Let's go on here to someone else. This is Champagne, and it's line 2. Hello.
Oh, hello. I'm very glad to hear about the FAIR Act, because I am pretty much disgusted. Of course, I am a Democrat. I've never seen anything like this. I can't see anything in history since probably the Bastille of the Ancien Régime of France that we have pretty much abrogated the whole Constitution of the United States with all the rights. I mean,
remember the John Adams and the Sedition Acts back 200 years ago? Yeah.
The Civil War, too. But,
yeah. Well, that's the Revolutionary War. Yeah.
This essentially, as you said, is excessive. And, you know, should not be really called a war. I'm sick and tired of these programs called War on Drugs, and so we throw too many young people into prison for minor offenses to start with. And then we call this a war when it should be a criminal police action. I mean, it's the same as McVeigh and Terry Nichols, who's just been, well, will be sentenced within a day or two. You know, this is the overreaction of everything has just gone so far that you know, the British citizens, Canadian citizens being thrown into Guantanamo and maltreated. I mean, we've had a couple of Canadian citizens report on the television of how they were maltreated in Guantanamo and arrested for no reason. Many people in Guantanamo are there because they were sold there. Fathers took their sons and said, and collected the $5,000 reward, and you know, said, "Oh well, he's Al Qaeda." I mean, that's the kind of crap that's going on down there. You know, people who are entirely innocent and are not allowed a lawyer, not allowed anything which the Constitution guarantees. And I wouldn't, frankly, I would vote for something on four legs who ate out of my dog's dish, rather than vote for bloody Bush again. I just want to tell you, goodbye.
All right. You can respond to that in any way you like.
Well, I think some of the criticism of the Patriot Act is well-founded. There were certainly areas. Barney Frank, who's my good friend, and we don't certainly agree on every issue for Massachusetts, is one who believes that certain upgrades to bring law enforcement into the 21st century were necessary. But I believe, and Butch Otter believes, a number of Democrats believe that we went too far and that we've got to look to see some of the sneak and peek provisions, for example, that are contained there. The expansion of powers beyond what the original intention of the Congress was, and frankly, the interpretation of some of those powers by the Department of Justice have been ones that need to be substantially pared back, and that's why I'm a sponsor of the bill that would do that.
We'll see if we can get at least one more caller, and that would be in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to thank you for your position in terms of not drilling on the North Slope in Alaska.
Thank you.
What happened in terms of, I wasn't really too happy with the energy bill. I know we have some bipartisan support in terms of building more of a fair energy bill, you know, in terms of renewable sources and things that, you know, that nature.
The energy bill right now is held up in the Senate. The energy bill, just like the budget or prescription drugs, is a I don't want to say a mishmash, but it's certainly an area that there is so voluminous that there's areas that I'm not entirely happy with. On the other hand, there are parts of the energy bill, hybrid vehicles, for example, wind power, biomass, renewable fuels, and others that I think are in the best interest of the certainly of the United States. Not to mention, quite frankly, the very significant provisions with respect to biodiesel and ethanol, which are important to Illinois farmers.
Right.
And so while I'm not in any area, including some of the provisions with respect to immunization for MTB, 100% happy with the energy bill, I do think it's something that needs to be enacted because we don't have an energy policy right now, nowhere to operate from, and we're just waiting, unfortunately, with gritted teeth for the next grid power shutdown because we don't have an energy policy.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, I remember the last energy crisis. I'm old enough to remember that one. And there was supposed to be a national policy in terms of energy, and it never did materialize.
Yeah, you're right.
There was a great deal to do. I had a mother that had a house that was, you know, insulated, and there was all kinds of things, and it really moved ahead. And then all of a sudden now, we're into this thing that, you know, we're using 20 million barrels of oil a day, and we're importing more than half of that. But, I mean, conservation, nobody talks about conservation anymore, and certainly nobody's going to talk about conservation in an election year.
Well, I voted, for example, to upgrade the CAFE standards for fuel efficiency. I voted consistently down the line to require vehicles made in Detroit to be more energy efficient. But a bipartisan, unfortunately, and combination of forces from both business and labor emerged to defeat our efforts to try to bring more fuel efficiency and conservation and clean air to our system. And those bills so far have failed.
I'm going to have to jump in here. I'm sorry. We have some other people that we can't take, but we're just at the end of the time. For now, we're going to have to leave it at that. I'm sure in another opportunity, though, a few months down the road will present itself, and Tim will be back, and we can do it then.
David, I appreciate it. I take it you and Celeste are going to be in New Brunswick again this year?
I expect we will, September, yeah.
Maybe I'm not 100% sure, but obviously one of the highlights of my summer about 10 years ago was running into David and Celeste in St. John's, New Brunswick, in a little down-home coffee place, and if I'm there again, maybe we'll run into each other again there.
Okay. Well, Tim Johnson, our guest, he's a representative in Congress from the 15th District. A lot of our listeners in the 15th, and we just wanted to give you the opportunity to talk to him.
So, I appreciate it. Thanks for the show.
Bye. Our show is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The broadcast is also made possible with support from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, offering beginner-level instruction in Iyengar yoga with special specialty class.